Okay, we're going to get started with, I have to say this for the tape, workshop number 244 part 1 and 245 part 2 of Organizing for Transformative Justice in Dangerous Times. So there will be a break in between the two parts. My name's Susan Leslie. I'm the Director of Congregational Advocacy and Witness at the UUA. And we just had a great initial kickoff, Love Resists, workshop in this room. And a lot of people were saying, okay, I get the frames and the concepts, but how do I actually go about doing this? And so that's why we thought, let's do a mini training right here at GA while we've got the energy, while we're up, while we're here gathered, confronting so many hard issues, both within and in society. So I really want to welcome Dr. Charlene Sinclair and Brittany Gray here. What do you say about people you've been organizing with for a few years? How do I keep it down? I'm going to be brief, and I want you to just fill in more about yourselves, okay? I first met Charlene before the Ferguson resistance happened. We were working on creating a movement to end mass incarceration. We had done lots of stuff with Michelle Alexander, and we were bringing together the faith community with organizations that Charlene was working with that were led by formerly incarcerated folks. At that meeting among UUs, we had State Action Network leaders, we had folks involved in congregation-based community organizing with groups like PICO and Gamaliel affiliates, and free-range activists. And we were really building some momentum, we thought. And Ferguson happened, and the world changed. And we're all still feeling that right now. I got to meet Brittany Gray shortly after, who's an organizer with Metropolitan Congregations United St. Louis for just a little while longer. And she became part of the Ferguson resistance as well. And since that time, we've been really throwing down together, going, how do we build a multi-faith movement that can flank and take the lead from these young, mostly young, you know, organizers who understand that intersectional frame, that this is who we need to be following. And the intersectional frame isn't just everything's connected. It centers dismantling white supremacy, which is moving all of this. It centers leaders of color. And so I have just learned so much from these two women. We started a campaign before Trump was elected called We Say Enough, where we would stand with those who are left out, and locked up. And many of you may have been on the calls we did with multi-faith clergy that we called On Call for the Movement. And we started those last summer. Charlene said, we've just got to do something. It was such a hard summer last summer. And then through the election, and we led up to a month of action that we did together. And that was in January. And then everyone was like, you know, we got to organize our own bases and then come together again. And that's how a lot of Love Resists got formed. So that's the UU piece of it. But it's part of a broader movement. And so Charlene and Brittany, with that frame, are going to help us drill down to what we've been doing hasn't really been working, right? Look at where we're at. The country's on fire. You know, so how do we organize differently and transform the world and create the world that we dream about, that we want to live in? Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Good afternoon. My name is Brittany Gray. I've been organizing professionally for 6 years, but I'm an artist at my core. And so if you don't like art, I'm sorry, because we're going to engage it a lot today. I'm also getting sick, so I apologize for my energy not being what it usually is, so just bear with me. It seems like without fail, whenever we are gathered together, there is something going on in the national scale that is traumatizing. And I oftentimes don't intend on opening up with this poem, but it almost always comes back around. So I'm just going to jump into it, and then I'm going to let Charlene introduce herself, and we're going to get into the workshop. I sat and spoke with a man who said, when oppression is eradicated in 20 years, my facial expression must have read all of my fears, because he had just told me of the 12-year-old girl who went to the pool but left with broken jaws and a cracked rib that the police thought was cool, and that they keep playing us in the media for a fool, ignoring the crimes of those in black bodies while making white women in blackface our hobbies. So I sit talking about being young, poor, and black in the hypothetical. Like it's not whack for bones to be cracked and police to continue to see slack, but when black people fight back, then the conversation is about what we lack. Not how we endure in the face of ongoing trauma, and I ain't talking about no your mama drama, but over 400 years of being brutalized and misutilized, this damn near genocide. Though we wouldn't dare call it that. Let's cut the bullshit. Because I just wish people would quit acting like there is a legitimate reason for black people on Wednesday night being killed in their house of worship. There is no more waiting. I am tired of waiting and standing in spaces where I am constantly debating all the right ways to process our feelings from an intellectual point of view. Cry for my people when they die. Cry for my people when they die. If you can just cry for my people when they die, that would be enough. Until you're ready to get in the tough stuff, save your words, because I have no more space for it.
So I'm going to take a deep breath. Let's all take a deep breath in and exhale. So Bertina and I, you know, we were just saying how our rhythm, we were saying how our rhythm connects oftentimes when we show up into spaces together. And I had no idea that that was how Bertini was going to open up this session. And there was a piece of me that was trying to just kind of hold it together while she was doing it. But what it reminded me of was the very first GA I attended. Because the very first GA I attended was right after Ferguson. It was the year after. And I remembered standing on the platform, and one of the last things that I said at that GA was, "Why can't you cry for my son?" So when you say cry for my people when I die, when they die, I was asking here at a GA, my very first one, why is it that y'all can't cry for my son? You know, so There's a sense of, Bertina says she's feeling sick. I'm actually physically okay, but I'm mentally, emotionally just weary. And so some of my energy is not about catching a cold. It's about being weary. And I'll be honest, if it were not for the fact that I am in the trenches with Susan Leslie, I probably would have said, I ain't coming. I'll be honest with you, because being hit with the Philando Castile lack of indictment in Wisconsin, like constant lack of indictment in the midst of this kind of death, when you have I have five grandchildren, one is a 9-year-old, when they have to talk about death in their everyday existence. You know, no 9-year-old child should grow up wondering about when they're going to die. You know, not at 9. You know, when you read you know, research papers that tell you that, you know, my grandson is not even considered a child, you know, but considered a grown man at age 9 or 10 or 11, capable of, you know, destruction enough so that if he were to be slain in the street, then we would have to be preoccupied with crafting a narrative about who he is to make people feel sorry for the fact that a child has been gunned down. What kind of world are we living in? You know, I remember a woman said to me, and I always think about this in my head, and we're going to get into some of this organizing, but I think that you need to kind of understand the context that we're doing this work in, because it is not simply an intellectual exercise, even though we demand intellectual rigor, because the complexity of this system of oppression demands intellectual rigor, right? We cannot afford for us to simply say we are good, kind people, and we don't do the hard work to understand how we are caught up and perpetuating, moving forward, a system that by its very nature requires the level of terror and brutality against all people, right? And so I remember this woman saying, you know, we say everything we can about Michael Brown, who was, what, 18? 18 years old. And the one thing that we never said was he scared? Has anyone in this room, in any of the murders that we have heard, has anyone heard or engaged in a conversation that asked, were they scared? Right? You're talking about an 18-year-old boy with bullets flying. Was he scared? Right? And so as we do this work, and as we push today to have you engage with us in thinking about this work, we are going to, like, seriously push ourselves, because we need to have every single person in this room and beyond, every person that you touch, every relationship you're in, every configuration that you find, how can you be, through your commitment to mental and emotional rigor, make this world a different place, right? Because it's not going to show up just by us smiling and being quote-unquote nice people. We got stuff to do, all right? So thank y'all for being here. Thank you for joining us, and let's start. All right.
So I want to hear from you all. What did you think you were coming into? What did you think this workshop was going to be about? Just stand up and project your voice. Did you say white privilege? Okay. Others. What project are you part of?
What?
What affiliate are you a part of?
It's called NOAA National.
I got you.
For Action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.
I just got tapped to be president of our tiny little fellowship, so I came to GA. And I was horrified that I might be part of the dominant narrative, like allowing destructive systems to prosper. I don't want that. I'm going to break that. There is. Show it to me. Let me break.
Yes. Two more.
I'm Emily from Franklin, New Hampshire. I'm part of a revitalized legislative network. It's New Hampshire Action. But once we have a legislative session that ends in June, so from January to June, we've been very active in the laws that are trying to get passed. Once June is over, what do you do?
Yeah, I'm from Union Crystal Ministry, Fort Illinois. We're trying to get people to think about a world without prisons, and what would a justice system look like that was just for everybody?
Thank you all for sharing. Second question. What do you want this session to be about? First one was, what do you think you were getting into? This question is, what do you really want? Front and then to the back.
I'm Claire from Boston. I'd like to figure out ways to take action with other churches beyond
Project with Columbia, Maryland, and related to that, I'm really interested in your perspectives on how to organize with and not for people of color in a predominantly white congregation without
One more. Yes. Thank you. All right. So if you have stuff with you, go ahead and put it under your chair. We're going to be doing some moving around for the next hour. And so you don't need to necessarily take your stuff, but we want to make your seat accessible to someone else. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to have four different corners. And you'll move depending on which of these you can most identify. So, the question at hand is, which of the following cases and people's story who have been killed by the police are you most familiar with? Your options are Philando Castile, you come to this corner by the screen. Sandra Bland, you can come to the corner by the stage. Charlena Laus, you can go to the back by the doors. And who's the other one? Oh, shucks. And then Sean Bell, you can go to that corner. So, Philando, Sandra, Sean Bell, Charlena Laus. So what have you observed, just that quick?
Nobody in that corner.
One person. What else?
No.
All right. Thank you. Other observations? Uh-huh. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Distinction between knowing the difference between men versus women.
Anyone else?
Mm.
There are so many names we never, or stories we never learn about.
So because this is so skewed heavily towards the front of the room, I'm going to ask those of you who do not know about the other cases but want to know more about the other cases to shift from your heavy groups. So if you're in Sandra Bland or Philando's group. So your options in this corner is Sean Bell. Your options in that corner is Charlena Laus.
Not everybody.
Some of you can stay where you are. We just want to mix up some of it. Mm-hmm. So now that you have split a little bit, self-segregate yourself into groups of no more than 10. Make sure there is at least somebody who knows about the case in your groups of 10. And spend about 10 minutes talking about what you know about this person. All right? Is that clear? Groups of 10, 10 minutes of conversation.
Thank you.
3 minutes. All right. So if I can have your attention. Can I have your attention? So the second part of this is to take this picture. Who's familiar with the picture? Okay, only some of us. No, so back up if you need to see. Who can tell us what this picture is?
It's the it's a soda counter, integrating the soda counter.
All right. So this is one of the infamous pictures out of Greensboro from the lunch sit-ins during the Civil Rights Movement. What I want you to do with this picture is to put it in conversation with the person whose group you're in. So, if you're in the group that has been talking about Sandra Bland, what would Sandra Bland's conversation be like if she was talking to the people in this picture? I want you to role play it. This is why I asked you to get in groups of no more than 10. This is time for your creativity. I'm not limiting to who in the picture this conversation can be with. So you may want to pick someone. You may want to pick a group. You may want to use everyone. Put the two into dynamic conversation. Do you understand? The people in the picture. So the picture is number one. Your number two is whoever's corner you are in. So Sean Bell, Charlena Lowes, Sandra Bland, Philando Castile. What would they say to each other if they could talk? 10 minutes. All right, so before we go, some people need an explanation of what's going on in the picture. So for those who cannot tell, can we dim the lights up here? Can somebody figure that out? They can just cut these lights here. All right, figure that out while I talk about what's going on in the picture. So what you have are both black and white students sitting at the counter, and you have what I would call an angry mob, a gang of white people who are resistant to change. And so their resistance has come out in the act of violence. They're disgracing those who are sitting at the counter with food, with drinks, with smiles. This is a joyous moment for some of them. If you look closely, and if we had a different picture, you'll see that that the crowd is not only men. There are at least a woman in the crowd. So what you have is the black woman whose face is most pronounced at the counter. She has some white stuff poured down her head. Could be a multitude of things. You can see the white guy whose arm is stretched with the woman with the bun in her head sitting at the counter getting ready to pour more onto her. If you look at the guy on the end at the counter, his jacket is completely covered in food. All right. Press play. Go ahead.
All right, everyone. Hello. Okay, everyone, let us return. Let us return. Stay in your groups, and I'm just going to walk around. All right? Stay in your clusters. Do I have everyone with me? I know these are tough conversations to have in such a short period of time, but what we wanted to do was to give you some like muscle on how to have some of these hard conversations, okay? Now, if we had more time, if this was a smaller room, we'd go around and have you talk about the conversations you've had, do some role play. But what I want to do in the few minutes that we have is really go around and get some observations around what came up for you. Please. I'm going to run and figure out, because I want everyone to hear each other.
So we had trouble getting started because many of us were thinking it's too hard to role play Charlena because it was disrespectful, or it was, I don't know, maybe hard or whatever. And because I just finished the Beloved Conversation curriculum where I got to role play a little bit, I decided to step in and do it. And my
my colleagues here really got into their role playing, and I found myself absolutely shaken. And what occurred to me is maybe doing the role play of Charlena is actually a sign of respect, because maybe it's getting me a little closer to how she might have felt.
You know, they say that one of the ways in which you can abuse someone, kill them, enslave them, is when you've created what they call a natal alienation, when you don't feel close enough to someone to actually feel full and complete responsibility for them. And so sometimes in our heads, we talk ourselves out of those deep relationships. I couldn't possibly know that because, you know, I'm not a black woman, or I'm not a man, or I'm not a this, or I'm not a that, right? But what does it mean to actually put yourself in the place of, what does it mean to be human, to be confronted by this level of violence, to want a good life for yourself? Where is the color around that, right? So we have to be careful, because there is a thin line between respect and abdication. Okay? Who else? Observations. I did popular education. I'll wait for you.
It was difficult. It was challenging. There were things that folks said in my group that gave me chills, and what you had said. But one of the things that stuck out for me was the folks in the picture, and then also with the police that came to her home and shot her, Charlene. What was her last name? Delias. That they're, you know, people were too wrapped up, the police, and I think people in that picture, too wrapped up in their own fear of things changing, or fear of their losing their station, or being reminded of, being reminded that they've been in, you know, endowed with privileges that they didn't earn, and not want to step out of that, and being very, very threatened, like, the same way they're threatening the bodily harm of the folks sitting at that counter is how they felt like they're harmed. They were being threatened as well, and that they were too wrapped up in their fear to notice anyone else's. And I think, it's hard to say, because it's really easy to demonize people on all sides. But a lot of it is just grounded in a lot of fear. And if you don't see me as human, there's no way you could think of me as being afraid of you.
It may not be obvious, but I'm a big white man. And I've had a few, not a lot, but enough encounters with the man to have some sense of what it's like when these people completely own the narrative and pull all power away from you. I'm not sure you have to entirely be that person to know what that feels like. I think we've all felt that someplace in our experience.
Thank you. I think it's really important to think about that, because, you know, one of the problems with liberal folk, I'm looking at everybody in here, okay, is that, you know, we think we're the good guys, right? We're the good guys. We're working for justice. And because of that, we tend not to interrogate ourselves. We tend not to ask ourselves, you know, how is the system that is operating actually ensuring that I'm okay? And so I hear a lot of conversations about, you know, giving up stuff. But people are talking about, like, not having two TVs, you know? So But what does it mean when giving up something means that you are vulnerable to death? What does that mean? I mean, that's the real question. Two TVs and shifting society so that that instability, unstableness, the fear, the questioning becomes something that we genuinely can experience. Because if I'm not afraid, if I think society's got my back, then how far am I really willing to go? Right? Community organizing is not missiology. Missiology. You know, people think it's mission work. I'm going to go do good things for those people. Right? Until we get to the place where we understand that we're crafting a society whose very foundation is about destroying the humanity of all of us, and secures that foundation by destroying folk that they have spent centuries in saying is not like you. Right? Those are the bad people. Those are the people to be feared. Those are the people that want your jobs. Those are the people that's going to break into your house. You know, if you spend centuries running that tape in the heads of folk, then you have spent centuries in saying, as long as you're not that, then you're okay. And so that means if you're white, as long as I'm not black. If you're black, as long as I'm not poor. You know, as long as I don't do that. So it's across the board. But until we get to the place where we begin to understand that what we're struggling for is not just a stop sign, you know, it's not just, you know, like X more jobs or one more dollar. It really is, as King said, a revolution of values. Because we're in a place where we have actually created a hierarchy of human value. And we think we're dealing with it by saying, okay, so do we have enough women in the room? Do we have enough men in the room? Do we have enough people of color in the room? Do we have enough da-da-da in the room? And then we think we're good. Not good enough. Organizing is about how do you get to those dark, hard places to restructure, pull up, who was I talking to about? Pull up by the roots. What we have come to actually hold on to because it makes us feel secure.
What does that mean practically to pull up by the roots this whole messed up system that's been?
Right. The first thing it means is this, because we don't do the interrogation. So this is what I mean about doing this complex work. If you don't do the work to understand what is whiteness, what is the role of whiteness in society? What is the role of blackness in society? What is the role of othering and dehumanizing people in society? And if we can begin to understand that, then we begin to see how we get structured so that we end up working against each other because we've aligned with that to the point where we're okay with not taking responsibility for each other as part of the broader human family. Right? Are you? Yeah. Did you want?
Time to switch.
Oh, sorry. Time to switch.
So before we switch, if you've ever called the police, raise your hand. Have you ever called the police? Practically everyone. Have you? Have you? Have you ever been scared to call the police? Fewer hands. Charlena Lyles called the police. She called because she thought someone was trying to break in to burglarize her. The police killed her instead. So don't tell me that you're uncomfortable stepping into that space, because you don't understand the fear of what it means to have to call the police and your life be on the line. So when we talk about organizing, we're talking about understanding that reality. So here's your second move. If you're familiar with these cases, these are the following corners you're going to go to. Dylan Roof. Bundy Brothers. James Holmes. George Zimmerman. Pick your corner. What corner is this? Bundy Brothers. What corner is that? What corner is this back here? James Holmes. What corner is this? George Zimmerman. What corner is this? Dylan Roof. So y'all don't know James Holmes? Holmes. Tell me who this is.
This is for the, we're familiar with the Bundy brothers.
Tell me what they did.
They took over a wildlife refuge in Oregon.
Armed or unarmed?
Armed.
Are they still living?
Yes, ma'am.
This is the Bundy brothers' corner. The Bundy brothers are the ones who took over government property in Oregon. Armed. 4 weeks. White. Still living. And acquitted. 30 seconds. Who is this?
James Holmes.
Tell me about it.
This was the Aurora Theater with the Batman movie and the break-in, and he killed a all kinds of people, and was put on trial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know. Lost track of the story.
He was declared insane and sent to some kind of facility.
That's right. Still lived. There is a direct contrast between these stories. This is connected to the work we do. This is the dominant narrative. So your goal, you can sit down for a moment because we're going to be in these groups until we break. We're going to talk about Audre Lorde. Audre Lorde says poetry is not a luxury. She says, I speak here. Stay in your group. Stay in the vicinity of your group. You're going to get back in those, but just sit down. She says, I speak here of poetry as a revelatory distillation of experience, not the sterile wordplay that too often the white fathers distorted it to mean in order to cover a desperate wish for imagination without insight. For women, poetry is not a luxury. It is a vital necessity of our existence. It forms the quality of the light within which we predicate our hopes and dreams towards survival and change. First made into language, then into action, then into more tangible, no, then into idea, then into more tangible action. Poetry is the way we help give name to the nameless so it can be thought. The following is also by Audre Lorde, poem entitled Power. The difference between poetry and rhetoric is being ready to kill yourself instead of your children. I am trapped on a desert of raw gunshot wounds and a dead child dragging his shattered black face off the edge of my sleep. Blood from his punctured cheeks and shoulders is the only liquid for mouths, and my stomach churns at the imagined taste while my mouth splits into dry lips. Without loyalty or reason, thirsting for the wetness of his blood as it sinks into the whiteness of the desert where I am lost, without imagery or magic. Trying to make power out of hatred and destruction. Trying to heal my dying son with kisses. Only the sun will bleach his bones quicker. A policeman who shot down a 10-year-old in Queens stood over the boy with his cop shoes and childish blood, and a voice said, "Die, you little motherfucker." And there are tapes to prove it. At his trial, this policeman said in his own defense, "I did not notice the sides nor nothing else, only the color." And there are tapes to prove that too. Today, that 37-year-old white man with 13 years of police forcing was set free by 11 white men who said they were satisfied justice had been done. And one black woman who said, "They convinced me." Meaning, they had dragged her 4 foot, 10 inch black woman's frame over the hot coals of 4 centuries of white male approval until she let go. The first real power she ever had, and lined her own womb with cement to make a graveyard for our children. I have not been able to touch the destruction within me, but unless I learn to use the difference between poetry and rhetoric, my power too will run corrupt as poisonous mold, or lie limp and useless as an unconnected wire. And one day, I will take my teenage plug and connect it to the nearest socket, raping an 85-year-old white woman who was somebody's mother, and as I beat her senseless and set a torch to her bed, a Greek chorus will be singing in 3/4 time, "Poor thing, she never hurt a soul, what beasts they are." Audre Lorde wrote that in 1978 due to a police case in Queens. Here's what you are to discuss. In your work, where is the rhetoric and how can it become poetry? Groups of no more than 10, where is the rhetoric and how can it become poetry? Go ahead. Let's actually get into your group of the white person who is still living. Actually make it groups of like 5 or 6. because we don't have that much time. So groups of five or six.
Hi, everybody. Hello. There was a question around what we're supposed to do. We want you to focus on what was just read through the poetry regarding the difference between rhetoric and poetry. Rhetoric being how you kind of mouth and speak what is already in the world. Poetry being how do you actually envision and move yourself to do something in contradistinction to that, right? Rhetoric, just the mouth, like how do we move in the world where we are now going to be honestly grounded in, does this really change anything? Or am I just in motion? And how can that become poetry, something real? Okay, good? All right.
That's what I'm saying. much more
All right, we've got 2 minutes.
All right, let's come back together. You go ahead and sit down. Yeah, just feel free to have a seat. Whatever is closest to you will do. If you don't want to sit, you don't have to. But if you want to sit, go ahead. We're going to go ahead and take some feedback, reactions. All right, so we just got a few minutes, and then we're going to break. So where's the poetry? Say more. Like, I'm looking for, like, what came out of your small groups. What was y'all talking about?
So I think a common theme in our group was the fact that we need the courage to be more radical and more authentic, but also courage to enter a space of making people feel uncomfortable, if that's what it's going to take. But not to be afraid to disrupt the boat, because we really need to engage in more poetry and less rhetoric.
Come on up to the mic. Y'all can go ahead and get a short line if you want to say something.
So trying to determine what is the actual rhetoric that we all received around the Bundy brothers and the takeover of the land by armed white men who were just held off and got off, I believe, and then trying to find some poetry. I got a couple little paragraphs here. Doctrine of discovery manifests destiny. These rights are self-evident. My whiteness gives me license to take what I want for the white common good. With law on my side, I shall not fear.
The thing that came to mind in our conversation was that rhetoric has to do with using words to try to change someone else. The focus being, it's the other person that needs to change. Poetry is going down to the depth of your soul, risking, and in that process often, usually, has much more effect on other people than trying to change them.
I just want to comment on a couple of the statements that have been made. So one is that the question of risk, because it is very difficult for us to take risk, to look deep into ourselves, not only to see how we may be complicit or how we may be in the world, but even to dream about something different. Like, when is the last time you really had a dream about a different world? Ain't a whole lot dreaming, right? Your poetry is about how you open up your mind and your heart to a possibility that you may not even see, but you want to believe in. So too often, we're just so trapped in our heads around what's pragmatic. What can we win? What is possible? How do we get it done, right? And we don't dream about the world we want and do whatever is necessary to move us towards that. And the rhetoric, the dominant rhetoric that we often hear is the tape that plays in our heads that constantly tells us that the world that we live in may have problems, but it's fundamentally okay, right? It may have problems, but if we work a little bit together, we can make it better because it's fundamentally okay, right? So unless we actually push ourselves to dream of a different world, then we have nothing to hold this world against. We have nothing to illustrate what's really wrong. We have nothing to push us towards the impossible unless we actually envision that. Okay? So poetry is that. You know, it's going to that place.
So a couple of different things, and this might be a little rambly because they're very separate from each other. But one of the things we talked about was that we know how to do rhetoric really well. Like, we can be in rhetoric for a long, long time. But the other thing so this part I'll talk to myself personally. But it was one of the things that I brought to the group, was it really hit me not knowing who Sean Bell was. Like, once I Googled it, I was like, oh, yeah, I remember, you know. But the fact of, like, Like, we know how to honor people's lives, and we know how to honor people's deaths when it's important to us. And so the fact that so few of us, and I'd say myself, didn't remember, and we know how to remember, right? And so we got into that conversation a little bit about how we do know how to remember, and we know how to honor people's lives, and we know how to honor people's deaths, and the importance of doing that. But then I'm not sure who it was in our group. That men in the orange shirt there talked about how the other thing for our group was a group of we were all white people in our group. And that how do we also, though, part of our heart work is looking at how are we like George Zimmerman? Like, maybe we wouldn't pull the trigger, but how much of that is in us? And recognizing that as well, and that's heart work. That's not rhetoric work. That's heart work, too, and saying, where am I like George Zimmerman? Where am I like Dylan Roof? You know, that. So that's... I'll pass on.
I just want to thank you, because the piece around any one of us could pull the trigger is so right and so important, because any one of us could pull the trigger. When you've been taught that there is something to fear from birth and generationally, anyone could pull the trigger. So really understanding that and then trying to like crack that and beginning to say, what's the work that I've got to do to first own the fact that I could pull the trigger and then start working around the different ways in which I've been taught that pulling the trigger is a natural response, right?
Rhetoric. It's the blah, blah, blah that gets nothing done. It's the blah, blah, blah that keeps the walls up, that darkens the glass, that deafens the ears. Poetry is reaching through the wall and assuming that the person on the other side, the person you don't really understand or know, means well, doesn't intend for this to go wrong, and reaching out the hand. Poetry is saying, oh my God, that was just a child. I can imagine my child. Oh my God, I had a son who did the same thing and he could be dead. The connection, the willful connection, the willful, I will feel this, instead of blah, blah, blah.
Let's make these 20-second snippets.
Okay.
So we can break.
This is a small step, and I think when one of these incidents happens, the rhetoric gets us into trying to understand all the details of it and justifying things and being with the perpetrator rather than the victim. And I think poetry is immediately going to the victim and understanding or being with them, not even understanding, but just being with them and grieving. And that, to me, is a dramatic difference in our reaction to it. And if we could just begin at that place instead of in the other place, that would help us.
Hi. So I have a whole lot of thoughts going on in my mind, so I'm sorry if I'm a little rambly and if I'm a little off base, please bear with me. But the thing that came to my mind when rhetoric versus poetry came up is that so many times in these spaces, particularly in UU spaces and General Assembly and our congregations, wherever, the vast majority of the people who are there are white folk. And so I feel that the majority of the time it's approached with this rhetoric sense, this I'm coming at it from my head. I have the option to be here in this space. I have the option to come here and talk about this. But besides that, I don't need to think about it when I walk on the street. Versus poetry being an overwhelming amount of experience that you live and feel and hurt and pain and broken openness again and again till there's nothing left to break open, that the only option you have is to get it out in some way, is that poetry. And I think that being afraid for, like, our white allies, accomplices, friends here, being afraid to make a mistake or say something wrong is valid and real, because we're brought up in these systems of systemic and oppression and white supremacy. But being so caught up in that fear that you don't show up is not okay. And it's been time, and it's past time, and showing up and being messy is okay, but show up and do the work. And y'all are doing that. You're here. But thanks. All right. Okay.
Thanks. So we want to give you a break. So we're going to come back at 5, and we will pick up with these parts of the reflection and move into our conversation about power. 5 o'clock.
How long is the break?
Till 5.